This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Spandrew Spice.
Welcome to Deep Cuts, the podcast where we pick a topic and walk you through the ins, the outs, and the nitty-gritty so you can appear like an interesting and idiosyncratic person at your next forced social function. Today's topic is...
the sex life of Salvador Dali.
Who was Salvador Dali? Well, he's arguably one of the most famous and iconic painters in modern history, responsible for being a pop culture figure, iconoclast, and... boundary pusher. The painter has been heralded as a genius for decades now. However, what would you think if I told you that Salvador Dali died a virgin? Act 1. I am not Picasso. Being an artist is never easy. Life requires compromises and negotiations, and being an artist usually requires absolute devotion. But what if you found yourself in a relationship that was simultaneously free of compromise and completely compromised? What would that unlock for you? Would it propel you to greatness? That is the crossroads that Salvador Dali navigated for his whole life, to varying degrees of success. Salvador Dali was born on May 11th, 1904, at 8:45 in the morning in Figueras, Spain. Or wait, no. Salvador Dali was born on October 12th, 1901, but died of gastroenteritis. How is that possible? Well, the world-famous painter was the second son of Salvador Luca Rafael Aniceto Dali Cusi, and he chose to name... both of his sons, Salvador Dali. Salvador Dali's father was a lawyer and a notary. His wife, Philippa Fetis, encouraged her small son's artistic endeavors as he grew up. However, his father would prove to be a deeply pivotal figure in the young Salvador Dali's life. He would take the small boy to a nearby cemetery where his brother was buried, and he would show the small child the gravestone with his own name on it. Dali would forever be haunted by visions of his brother. He would be enshrined in his paintings, writings, and everything he generated throughout his life. In an interview about his older brother, Dali said,
"He was probably the first version of myself, but conceived too much in the absolute."
So, I feel like we should talk about this a little bit. Salvador the First showed up in a bunch of Salvador Dali the Second's paintings, or I guess technically Salvador the Third, because his dad was Salvador the First.
Yeah, that's really dark to think about it like that from a young age. Just be taken out and shown this gravestone and to internalize it as, like, I'm the second attempt at Salvador Dali. My brother was the first one, and then he died. And then they were like, all right, here's the second one. So you better get it right this time. And to have that put on you of, like, I need to, like, be the good Salvador Dali that doesn't die and, like, makes it.
I think there's also just something about children and their developmental process where they shouldn't be aware of what sex is or what death is early on in life. Those ideas are so large that they shape you in almost universally negative ways if you're exposed to them too early. And the idea that not only would you be exposed to the concept of death, but the literal you are going to die. It's not like, oh, grandma so-and-so or uncle so-and-so passed away. Like, my uncle died when I was really young. He had cancer. And I met him, and I kind of understood what death was, but not really. And, like, I don't think it had a particularly adverse effect on me because I didn't know him all that well. And I also didn't really understand what cancer or death was, right? And also, I think this person wasn't even really my uncle. I think he was, like, my dad's cousin, but we just called him uncle.
So they were married then?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, they were married, yeah. But, like, you know, that's the kind of thing of when you're exposed to something in a glancing way, like, of course, it'll have effects on you. And the closer the blast radius is of that trauma is to your everyday life, the more it's internalized, especially when you're a child. But, like, man, the fact that it's you, the fact that you at, you know, basically 3, 4, however old he was when they actually told him, like, so just so you know, you're like the second attempt at this guy. Like, that's so fucked.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about it before, and I actually recently was talking about it in the Discord for some reason, but I agree with everything you were saying. Just thinking of my own experiences, I remember that, like, having no real direct relationship with death as a child up into a certain point where I just really didn't have a concept for it. And whenever I first started to play around with thinking about it was in, I think, the same way that many kids do, where you just start kind of becoming a little self-aware about the idea of death, and you hear people talking about it, and then you start asking questions about it. And then, like, my conception of it was just talking with my mom about it and her saying, like, yeah, we all die, but, like, it's not going to happen for a long time. And I think that that is, like, it's a good thought terminating argument for a kid, and it's comforting to just think about it as this thing that's going to happen in this, like, imperceivably far amount of time that you don't have to worry about for the foreseeable future, which as a kid means, like, never. Like, it's just out of sight, out of mind. And I think that that's, like, a pretty good way of internalizing the concept of death when you're very young. And then I remember that all kind of coming crashing to the ground whenever my grandma was dying of cancer. And I think that the way that my parents chose to expose us to that was not particularly healthy. Mostly my mom. My mom was, like, very close with her mom. And I don't think that the way that she chose to include us in that was very good for us as kids. My grandma had lung cancer, which is a lot more treatable. I mean, cancer is still just this wild card of, like, health, where sometimes it just comes out of nowhere and then you're just fucking gone. But there's a lot of cancers that are a lot more treatable now. But back in the day, lung cancer was, like, just not treatable at all. And there was all these experimental forms of chemotherapy and things like that. So my grandma went out to this hospital in Lubbock, Texas, where they had this really good cancer doctor, and they were using these newer, more experimental forms of chemotherapy and radiation to treat it. And so we all just basically went and lived out there, and we stayed in a hotel by night and then just sat in the hospital waiting room all day. That's where I lived for a couple months. I was just taken out of school and I lived in this hospital. I've talked about this before on the show. And then I remember the day when it happened, we were down in the hospital food court, and the one and only time I've ever had Chick-fil-A, we ate Chick-fil-A. And then I came back up, and my grandma, they were like, oh, she's dying. And we went in there, and I, like, said goodbye to her, and she was, like, almost dead. And then they took us out of the room, and I went to the bathroom or something like that. And then I walked back, and I thought that everybody was still in that room, and I opened the door and walked in, and it was empty and dark, and it was just my grandma's body. And number one, I've never had Chick-fil-A again. That's why I was talking about in the Discord. I was saying, like, there's this debate about whether you should eat Chick-fil-A because of the anti-LGBTQ groups that they support. And, like, people are like, oh, well, there's no ethical consumption under capitalism. And there's all these other places you eat that also support these bad things. And it doesn't matter. And blah, 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 blah. There's this, like, debate about it. And I was just saying, like, it's never been hard for me because I've never fucking eaten at that place because I'm traumatized from it.
Is it actually that, or are you doing it as a bit? Like, because you're vegetarian, so you wouldn't eat there anyway. But, like, do you actually have that association? Like, you have been, you know, like, maybe at times when you weren't vegetarian, you had the opportunity to eat there, and you're like, no, I can't fucking do it.
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely I wouldn't eat there now unless they introduce, like, vegetarian options, like plant-based stuff. Like, Dave's Hot Chicken has a plant-based version of their chicken sandwich, which is fucking delicious, by the way, if you haven't had it. But yeah, no, I mean, I have a weird thing about that place. Like, I just never wanted to go there. I just have a vivid memory of, like, running up the staircase with my cousin, and we had the Chick-fil-A cups, and we were, like, laughing, and we, like, opened the staircase out into the waiting room, and we just saw people just stone-faced, And it all just was immediately grim. And then from that moment on, it was just the downhill spiral to she was dying. And it did not have a good effect on my family for the next 5 or so years. It was a bad time. But also, you know, aside from the Chick-fil-A thing, which obviously is not that big of a deal, just my general, like, I'm just really scared of going to hospitals. I have a really weird relationship with going to see doctors. I kind of can't do it without my wife going with me. I really just am really weirded out by going to doctors and hospitals because of this. And yeah, I think just a weird relationship with death, a weird kind of traumatized relationship with death. That's ultimately my point in this long story, is like, that wasn't a great way of interacting with death as a kid. And I think I had a pretty healthy relationship with it up until that point. And now I'm very scared of death. I think about it probably too much. And I think it was all because of that interaction with it I had. So ultimately, to your point, I can't imagine this, where it's like, that was my grandmother. This is like, you died. And now you're reincarnated and you have to like try again. I feel like that would fuck you up.
Yeah, I think it probably would. And I feel like we're going to get into that in this episode, that it inarguably did. Salvador Dali also had a sister, Anna Maria, who was 3 years younger. He would paint her 12 times from 1923 to 1926. And it would be in these portraits that we would get our first sense of how malformed or strangely innocent Salvador Dali's sexual proclivities were. So, you know, this episode is inspired by the fact that when I was in Spain recently, I went and did a bunch of Salvador Dali stuff. I went to his house, which we'll get into later. I went to his museum that he designed and is buried at in Figueres. And then I went to the town that he summered in as a boy, Caracas. That was really fun. And then also I went and saw a statue that he designed in Andorra, which is a country I did not know existed prior to going to Andorra. It's the 6th smallest country in Europe. It's basically just a city and a bunch of fucking ski lifts.
Speaking of which, I don't mean to derail this, but I just have to quickly point out that, speaking of things that you don't know, there's some discourse going on in the Discord where people are talking about the fact that marrying your cousin is way more common than you think it is.
Really? I'm out of the loop on this? Are we talking like in contemporary times? Motherfuckers out here just like marrying their cousins?
Kind of contemporary times, but more just historically. It's just a way more common thing. And somebody showed a map of the United States today, and there are actually very few states where marrying your cousin is illegal. There's more states where it's totally legal than there are states where it's illegal. There's only like 4 or 5 of them where it's criminalized. And just a lot of people talking about how they know somebody who just like is either a product of cousin marriage or is married to their cousin. And actually, I didn't even think about this, but my mom's best friend is a cousin baby. She's a product of a cousin and a cousin's marrying.
All right. I don't think I'll be partaking, but to all the freaks in the Discord, have fun marrying your cousins. Yeah, so these paintings that he did of his sister, they're kind of interesting. One, he has a very strange relationship with the female form in his early paintings. A lot of them are just like, I'm a painter, therefore I must paint a naked woman. But they almost feel like he's like holding his nose and doing it. Like he's like not interested in painting the female form. He basically painted like one of his sister's friends nude reclining. You know, it's the classic nude in repose style painting. You can tell he's like physically uncomfortable painting it, because like the background is painted really well, and then like the nude figure is like, I don't know. I guess it's this. Which is interesting. This will come to play later in terms of how some of these things are going to manifest. Another thing that he does early on in his career is he has this motif of painting women facing away from the viewer. And if you scroll down, Spandrew, you'll see one that he painted in 1925. It's called Young Woman at a Window. And it's a painting of a woman standing at a window looking out over a bay. And this motif of like people facing away from camera, specifically women facing away from the point of view, is also something that he returns to a lot early in his career, which could just be a theme. But in context with some of the other stuff we're going to be discussing about Dali's visual proclivities and also his specific relationship with women and a female identity, I think is germane for this discussion.
Also just very formalist, very pre-modern classical compared to what we think of as a Salvador Dali painting. This is a very formalist painting. Just for the listener at home, just a woman facing a window, kind of looking out on an ocean front, I think. And it just looks like a very well-rendered painting.
Yeah, it's interesting because in the museum in Figueres, there's a bottom room of the museum that's all his, like, early work, the stuff that he did when he was, like, first getting started as a painter. Because he had, like, his first show at, like, 14 or 16 or something. Like, he was really young, something of a wunderkind. And he had all these opportunities given to him because a lot of high-profile painters are from the region of Spain that he's from, Catalonia. And the early works that are housed specifically in that room of the museum in Figueres are, like, it's crazy. It's like he's completely voiceless. Like, this one is a Francis Bacon painting, and this one is a Manet, and this one is a Monet, and this one is, like, it's, this is him trying to do, like, a, you know, a Da Vinci-style study. Like, it's so fascinating to see somebody who we all view as having such a distinct, specific voice visually as a painter, and knowing, like, of course you know that they weren't fully formed, right? Of course you know that. Every artist has to evolve. Every artist has to figure out what they're doing and what their voice is. But it's so cool to see him figure that out of, like, oh, this painting, that corner is totally, you know, insert great painter here, and that corner is Picasso, and this corner is, you know, Cézanne. And, like, it's really interesting to see that voicelessness kind of congeal over the course of both literally in the museum as you're walking through it, because it's a very well constructed museum, but also just as an artist, as a career coming together. It's fascinating.
I don't know if you're aware of this, like, anti-intellectual, anti-modern and postmodern art discourse and debate that's, like, going on mostly on social media. I see it a lot of it recently on TikTok, where people are just shitting on modern art and acting like it's this made-up bullshit where a bunch of, like, pretentious people just do splotches and pretend like it's a masterpiece or whatever. There's a weird newly found backlash against modern art on social media where people are acting like it's just a bunch of, like, talentless hacks who are just creating this fake idea of what art is so that they can, like, gatekeep it from people and act like they don't understand it, which there is definitely a component of that. I mean, we've seen Exit Through the Gift Shop. We've talked about that on the show before. There's definitely a component of that. And there are definitely people that just, like, go to a fucking art installation and they, like, get a pile of dirt and then they, like, put the dirt on the wall, and then they're just like, this is a masterpiece, pay me $50,000. There's definitely a component of that. But to just completely hand wave the entirety of modern and postmodern art as just a bunch of pretentious people acting like something is art when it's not is just so absurd and very disturbing to me. And this is a great example of it. It's like that scene in Art School Confidential where he's like, what are those triangles on the wall? John Malkovich is like, it took me 30 years to learn how to paint like that, which obviously was a joke in the movie, but it's, like, real. It's true. Salvador Dali could paint like this. He could just paint like a beautiful neoclassical formalist painting. And then he developed a voice which took him off in surrealist ways and in a direction that some people would regard as like, oh, this isn't, like, good painting. But he wasn't not capable of that. He just developed a voice and had something to say that wasn't just like, look at this beautiful landscape or this wonderful portrait.
Salvador Dali attended municipal drawing school in Figueres in 1916 and fell in love with painting. He experimented with a variety of styles and became something of a preternatural mimic. It would be around this time that Dali's father began showing his son photos of venereal disease-ridden vaginas, attempting to instill a sense of caution in the young boy. However, the exposure to these horrific images permanently scarred Dali, and he would never have penetrative sex with anyone for as long as he lived. Or at least, that's what the legend says.
Me and Salvador Dali's dad had a little bit in common, because, I definitely didn't do this to a child, because that's horrifying and emotionally scarring. But you know how whenever you airdrop something to somebody, it just automatically pops up on their phone screen?
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, oh, you have a file, open it. But when you airdrop something, it just appears on their screen. So when we'd be sitting in our living room, I would just airdrop pictures of, like, dicks with venereal diseases on them.
Man, 2009 hit different, man. Now that's the kind of shit that gets you canceled.
I wouldn't do that to just, like, somebody I didn't know very well. But also, I probably wouldn't do it at all anymore. But at the time, it was funny as fuck.
Like I'm saying, this is how you get canceled. I've never done anything like that, and I never would need to do anything like that. I'm a good boy. God damn it. All right, moving on. In February of 1921, Salvador Dali's mother died of uterine cancer. He was 16 years old. After her death, Salvador Dali's father married her sister because, you know, it's the 1920s.
This is cousin marrying adjacent. Let's just say that. It's cousin marrying adjacent. But also, apparently, it was very common to do this in the 20s, 30s, and 40s.
That is what I was about to say. Yeah, it's more or less like today, I think this would be very verboten and people would be like, you're just trying to replace your dead wife. And back then they were like, oh, yeah, you're just trying to replace your dead wife.
Yeah, it's like, you need this.
Yeah, like, oh, she's the sister. She's the same genetics, more or less. Like, it's basically the same.
Yeah.
This one's the busted one. Too bad the pretty one had to die.
The first choice is dead. You might as well settle for the runner-up. Yeah, the central inciting incident of the movie The Boy and the Heron is that the main character's mom dies and then his father marries her sister. And I looked it up out of curiosity. And yeah, it was very common to do that. And also in Japan specifically, it was like almost expected. If your wife died and had a sister, like, you probably should marry her. Because your children need, like, a mother that was kind of the same as their real mother.
Weird, man. Deeply weird. But, like, just to, you know, recap, this dude, his dad has decided, A, they're kind of wealthy, right? Because being a notary and being a lawyer at this time specifically, like, it's very prestigious culturally. So they're kind of wealthy. So he's, you know, like, a silver spoon kid whose mother dies. His father is like, also, you're the second attempt at being a human. And also, look at how scary women are. Like, they're fucking monsters. Like, look at this. And spoiler alert, this permanently warps Salvador Dali. In maybe not so great ways. Or maybe great ways, depending on, I don't know.
Listen. For, like, that dare police officer that would come into your school in the 90s and tell you that the only 100% certain way of avoiding sexually transmitted diseases is celibacy, this is great. For that guy, this is the best thing. For everybody else, this is, like, a fucked up, super backward thinking, super deeply misogynistic, puritanical way of looking at life. But for Officer Daniels, this is the dream.
Around this time, Dali had his first solo show, you know, his first solo painting exhibition. Remember, he's like 16 when this happens. So Pablo Picasso, because he also, I think, was originally from Catalonia, but he was living in Paris at the time, but he knew the art dealer that was putting on the show. And the art dealer invited Picasso to come look at the show in a private viewing before it opened. And Picasso, at this point, is like the greatest artist in the world. And everyone is obsessed with him. And Dali wants to be him. So when Picasso comes to the show, he, you know, he kind of looks at the works and is kind of like, oh, wow, these are really good. But, you know, you're a kid, like, you have some maturing to do. And Dali, he doesn't take that too well at this point. He wants to be like, I want to be a fucking genius now. And so he enters something of a, like, Picasso period for a little bit. He, like, starts becoming obsessed with Pablo Picasso and starts trying to experiment with painting like him for a little bit. And this was around the time that Picasso was in his blue period. If you're unfamiliar, Pablo Picasso was a little bit of a womanizer, and there was a model in Paris that he and a couple of his artist friends all sexually desired, and they decided that they would share her, and one of the artists fell in love with her and became obsessed with her. And when Picasso was habitually being intimate with this person, this artist killed himself, and she ended up marrying and running a restaurant for like 50 years with one of the other artists. There was like three or four artists in their little like friend group, and so she ended up marrying one of those other artists. But Picasso really blamed himself for that suicide. And that's what the blue period is all about. It's all him painting his friend who had shot model and one of her other lovers and committed suicide. They survived. Actually, I don't think he shot her. I think he just shot one of the other artists and killed himself. And Picasso blamed himself for this. I think somewhat deservedly so. Like, I think he was like not giving a shit about this woman at all and was just kind of like, hey, what's up? Let's fuck. And the other guy was like in love with her and he didn't care. He was still kind of, you know, having fun in the evening. And it really drove the other guy over a cliff and he ended up committing suicide. An attempted murder suicide, but thankfully it just ended up as a suicide.
Yeah, there was a situation like that that almost happened with us one time, where one time I came out of the kitchen, I was checking the fridge and I came out, I walked in and you were sitting there and I was like, oh, hey, Dave, hope you didn't mind, but I ate this leftover jasmine rice. And then you just got this look on your face. I had to send wellness checks for like weeks after that. Like, it was touch and go with you.
Yeah, that's.
And similarly, I didn't care. I was just like, this is just rice to me.
In 1922, Salvador Dali moved to Madrid and studied at the Real Academia de Bellas Artes de San Fernando.
Got that all right. That was all 100% right. They're actually impressed.
There, he befriended a group of artists working under the collective name Ultra. During this time, Dali was honing his mimicry skills and, you know, literally making paintings in the style of the Impressionists, in Picasso, you know, the giants of the art world. He was obviously searching for his quote-unquote voice during this time period. In 1927, Dali would fall into a group of people that were working in service to an idea that was loosely being called surrealism. The core tenets of surrealism at the time is that true art comes from the subconscious. Writers, sculptors, filmmakers, and other artists were all attempting to find ways of accessing the subconscious in order to create art that would speak to issues larger than their lived experience. Dali was taken by this idea and wasn't sure how exactly to paint using this, because in order to paint and utilize craft, you have to have an extreme sense of choice and observation. He utilized a method of falling asleep holding a spoon. When the spoon would fall, the noise would wake him up, and he would write down what he had seen in this waking sleep state and then paint that.
Oh my god, that's how this show is edited. No joke, the process of the show being edited is me just, and I'm saying this on an episode that is edited by somebody else. We have an editor now, so I don't have to do this anymore. Shout out to Louis Pagy. Don't want to sound like I'm snuffing you.
Big Pagy. We only refer to him as Big Pagy around these parts.
Shout out to the Big Pagy. But when I did edit the show, that was how the show was edited. It was literally just like me sleeping, and then like my hands hitting the keyboard would wake me up, and then I would like edit 3 more minutes and then nod off and then wake up and edit 3 more minutes and then do that for the whole fucking episode.
So these two paintings, some of his first attempts at surrealism using that kind of like subconscious mining method. What do you think of these two paintings?
Yeah, they're great. I love Salvador Dali's work.
Do you want to describe them maybe a little bit?
Yeah, we've got the first one is like a sort of surreal beachfront area. So we've got like not sand, but some kind of little beach area with some like little kind of weird abstract plant growths coming out of it. And then just like some abstract geometric patterns and shapes kind of just like jutting out of the ground. And then like a dead donkey carcass. And then the form of like a woman's nude body without a head or feet or hands. And then what looks like abstract looking blood pooling from out of the body, but it's more of just like a really like jagged geometric shape. And then that leads out into like an ocean or like a river or lake or something like that, with a few other random geometric shapes and little pieces of plant life randomly in the water. And then the second painting feels like in a very similar theme, same color palette, same general looking landscape, except for now we're kind of in the middle of an ocean. In the back, there's these sort of mountainous area kind of in the far distance, and then this sort of like expressionistic looking blurred sky. And then in the foreground, on this little square that's like in the middle of the water, are just a bunch of different abstract geometric shapes that are kind of stacked. And there's like this cone that has like an upside down triangle on top of it. And then on top of that is this sort of like musculature looking hand with a lot of little like jagged lines around it that give it like focus and also give it like some movement. Looks like there's a lot of like movement and life coming out of the hand as opposed to the rest of the painting, which is all very like sterile and these geometric shapes. And then there's like these random, there's a donkey that is alive and it's composed of geometric shapes that's on the little square. And then there's like a little abstract form of a person that is also composed of geometric shapes. And then in the sky, there is just another realistically rendered bust of a nude woman.
Because what else would you do?
Yes.
These pieces were selected for the annual Autumn Salon in Barcelona of October of 1927. And Salvador Dali started to get noticed from people in the Spanish art world because of these avant-garde works. Dali starts going down this road more. He becomes more interested in surrealism and exploring his subconscious because of the success of these works. However, his next work is rejected from the Autumn Salon the following year, and then he's interviewed in a notable art magazine because of the scandal surrounding the rejection, which only hypes him up more. In 1929, Dali meets someone who will change his life forever. His future wife. The person who will shape his career. A woman named Gala. Act 2, The Great Artist's Wife. Gala, a.k.a. Elena Ivanova Dyakonova, was born in Kazan, Russia in 1894. During her teenage years, Gala was sent to a sanatorium in Clavandale near Davos in Switzerland. While there, she met Paul Elard and fell in love with him. The two were 17 at the time. In 1916, during World War I, she traveled from Russia to Paris to reunite with him. They were married, and they had one child together. However, motherhood would not be for Gala, because, you see, in 1929, at a party, Gala met Dali, and, as legend goes, told Paul that they would be getting a divorce and that their daughter would go live with his mother. And she was going to be with Dali and live with him from now on.
That's some epic riz.
Dude.
That's all the riz.
Just wait till you learn more about their story. I think it might be the opposite. I think it might be her realizing, oh, I can control every aspect of this human's life and manipulate them and like puppeteer them as like a meat puppet. I've heard of two different versions of the story. One where like literally the first time she met him, she was like, this guy, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make him the greatest artist in the history of artists. And then another that was like, they knew each other for a really long time. And the party was where she finally made the decision. And that's kind of the story that has caught on publicly in terms of the romantic, more whimsical idea that she would meet him and be like, I'm going to burn my life down to the ground for you. Before we kind of get into some more details about her, I just want to explain this trope of the great artist's wife. In the art world, there's a trope called the great artist's wife, where not everyone, but most artists that are very successful have a partner or wife who has a very specific personality type and kind of does all of the shit that they don't want to do or can't do. Gala being like the chaotic evil version of it, Roz Kirby being the, you know, probably lawful good version of it, and then like, you know, there are people in the middle, like, you know, Andrew Wyeth's wife again was another person like that. She handled the business, she paid the bills, she cataloged his artwork, she also was responsible for orchestrating a scandal that made it seem like he was cheating on her, but she did it to hype up the value of this specific group of paintings that he had kept secret for like 40 years. Or not 40, it was like 15. So there's a trope in the art world of these people who are romantic partners to the artist. They're not the artist, but they're kind of like the Hillary Clinton, you know, the person behind the scenes who isn't the duly elected official, but is one doing lots of work and handling things that need to be handled. And that trope of person, I've seen it. Like, I have friends that they're partners are the great artist's wife 100%, and they never get the credit they deserve, and it's usually a very good thing. Gala is a very interesting permutation on that trope.
Yeah, and there are sometimes conspiracy theories about the fact that like they're actually the one that is doing the art for real, and sometimes that's true. Like the Big Eyes paintings, like Margaret Keane, like her husband said that he was doing these paintings and the entire time it was her.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's not as true. Like there are conspiracy theories that Einstein's wife was the one that actually created the general theory of relativity, but there's no proof of that. But frequently there are these like, oh, how intermingled are their relationship and how involved is she in the work that he does is very frequently a topic of debate.
Yeah. Okay, so we got some images here. One that's a painting of Gala and one that's a photo of her as a young woman. What do you think of Gala? What does Gala look like?
She looks like a pretty stereotypical like 1920s flapper type girl. I mean, she doesn't have the little headband thing. She's got that the flapper style makeup and she's wearing like the chunky neck jewelry. She looks very much almost like a German expressionist actress. She looks like maybe like a third grade teacher. She's got some third grade teacher vibes going on.
Oh man, you're in for some exciting developments.
Also, this painting, who is this painting by?
That's a painting by Dali.
Okay, so I just wanted to make sure, but that's interesting because in this discussion of his discomfort with the female form based on these early childhood traumas of his father just exposing him to these like venereal disease pictures and saying that this is what's going to happen to you if you touch a dirty, dirty woman. And then you can see that in his like more surrealist artwork, you know, using these paintings as an example, this subconscious like desire to render the female form, but almost like be removed from it. So you have these like headless, identityless, nude female busts where he's removed the humanity from the objectified female form and just displayed it as this sort of like sterile representation of a nude person. Almost like, oh, I like the female form. I'm attracted to it. But this version of the female form can't hurt me. It can't give me diseases and break my heart because the brain is removed. It's just the body. And this almost like shyness about rendering it where he removed from it by using these more kind of like general geometric shapes to render the female form in this very cold and sterile way. And then in this painting, it's number one, like a greater comfort in rendering the female form in a more naturalistic way. It focuses on the identity of the woman rather than the body. And then also, it's got this almost like Oedipus-esque, she's got like her shirt open, just revealing one of her breasts in this almost like motherly breastfeed from me type way, like that she's presenting herself as like, come and nourish yourself from my body, which is almost this way more healthy relationship with the female body of like, nourish yourself from me, not like just look at me in this cold, sterile way and be attracted to my body removed from its head. There's something interesting about that.
One, I think you're right on the head. That was a weird way of phrasing it. You hit it right on the nose in terms of, I think being in a relationship with Gala and some of the stuff we're about to get into opens up Dolly's mind and in some ways reinforces some of those traumas and in some ways alleviates some of them. But also, I think the Gala version of the great artist's wife is very intertwined with motherhood and also very intertwined with the fact that Dali's mom died when he was so young and that Gala in some ways is both a stand-in. She is his wife, but also they don't have sex, but also we're going to get into something very specific that they do, and she controls and acts as a mothering figure to him almost to a detrimental degree, which is, again, fascinating. This next photo of them is a staged photo that is basically an explanation of the great artist's wife trope, where Dali is in his chair painting. I've seen that chair in person. That's so weird. I just realized this. That chair is at his house in his studio in Port wherever, where the home that he lived in when he moved back to Spain is. But he's got an easel with a piece of paper on it and an ink drawing, and there are pulleys rigged up to his face and hand in the way that like you would control a puppet. And Gala is sitting next to him utilizing those pieces of string in a recreation of She's the Puppeteer, which is so fascinating that they are aware that this is what is happening. Because sometimes people slip into habits and routines and it's not something that either one of them is necessarily like super conscious of. It's just like, oh, I'm not good at sending emails. You send the emails and I can't paint. So you do the painting and we'll have a business. Okay, let's keep going. But like this is a very outwardly projected Gala is the puppeteer, Dali is the marionette.
But rendered in a really interesting way, because unlike the image of puppeteering somebody that everybody conjures to mind is the image of like somebody sitting there and then there's somebody standing over them with those wooden crosses with the marionette strings, which creates this vision in your mind of sort of like ulterior motives. There's somebody controlling this person from behind the scenes and they have an agenda and there's some kind of shadowy reason for why they're controlling them. In this photo, instead of standing over controlling him with these sort of outstretched arms, she's down and to his side and she's sort of like very delicately pulling the strings, which creates much more of an idea in your mind of like somebody trying to guide and steer somebody's vision without drawing attention to themselves, as opposed to like, I'm controlling you and I have some hidden agenda for why I'm doing this.
Totally. This next line is a quote. Do you want to read this?
I would polish Gala to make her shine, make her the happiest possible, caring for her more than myself, because without her, it would all end.
Wrote Salvador Dali. Gala became very involved in the burgeoning surrealist movement as well. She became friends and sexual partners with many of the founding members of the movement. She was closely linked to Louis Aragon, Max Ernst, André Breton, and, of course, was married to Paul Allard. In fact, she was in a throuple with Ernst and Allard from 1924 to 1927. After meeting Dali, however, she parted ways with Allard and dedicated herself exclusively to him, trying to make him the greatest artist in the history of the earth. In 1931, Salvador Dali paints The Persistence of Memory. This is maybe his most famous painting.
We've all seen it. We all know it.
We've all seen it. We all know it. It's basically clocks melting on a surrealistic landscape. And it, along with a bunch of other works that he makes during this time period where he's fully ensconced in the surrealist movement and utilizing this kind of spoon technique to harness his subconscious, it really propels him to the next level. And he becomes something of a known artist in Europe. He's very well known in Europe, but not as known in the United States yet.
You that clock melting guy?
Yeah, exactly.
You the guy that melts the clocks?
Because they were both devoutly Catholic, the pair could not technically get married. They had a civil ceremony in 1937, right at the beginning of the Spanish Civil War. Around this time, things became very untenable for artists in Spain. So Dalí and Gala went to Pablo Picasso, another recurring figure in this story, and they asked him to loan them enough money to get on a boat to the United States. He did, and thus Dalí's meteoric rise really took off. They sailed from Bordeaux to Lisbon to New York in August of 1940. This is a photo of him around that time. And as you can see, his trademark mustache with the ends curled up going straight towards his eyeballs hasn't yet manifested.
It's like the origin story. This is the, who are you here with? Nobody. I'm solo. Solo?
Yes. Are you Salvador Dalí? Yes. But I don't have a mustache yet, so I'm not fully Salvador Dali. I'm not going to get that until the last shot of the movie. Dali spent the winter of 1940 at Hampton Manor in Caroline County, Virginia, where he worked on projects including his autobiography and paintings for an upcoming show. They then moved to New York, and Dali marked his new home with a definitive statement, "Surrealism is dead." He put on a show, ironically, of like 19 new surrealist paintings, and it was just like, "Surrealism, it's fucking over, bros.
I bodied it."
Which is really funny because he walks that back immediately. But let's talk about these paintings really quick. Slave Market at the Disappearing Bust of Voltaire is the first one, and the second one is The Face of War. Both of these paintings exhibit interesting levels of rendering and the quintessential idea that Dalí loved of an image inside of an image, two things being true at the same time. It is both, you know, people in a little town square bidding on slave workers, theoretically, and then also a literal, like, transformative image where if you look at it the right way, two of the characters' figures are interlaced in a way that it makes Voltaire's face. In the same way that there's another one, which is a nude woman standing at a window facing away from us. And if you squint at it, it's Abraham Lincoln's face. He loves that idea of two things being true at the same time. The dichotomy of an image within an image, or two opposing ideas that shouldn't go together going together. The Face of War is a large brownish blackish face with its eyes and mouth housing smaller versions of the same face, and those eyes and mouths housing smaller versions of those, so on and so on and so on and so on.
Yeah, which is also another theme of smaller pieces making up a larger object, and you have to sort of like look more closely to recognize that this larger object is comprised of a bunch of smaller objects, you know, like the skull that is a series of women stacked onto each other, thing he does commonly.
Yeah, and I think that that is, you know, related in some way to either his sexual identity or his gender identity, which at the time, I don't think he specifically wanted to confirm or be specific about any of those things, or maybe didn't have the words for it himself, which we're going to get into in depth. But I feel like we should start seeding that a little bit here of this kind of idea that, you know, there's a lot of discomfort with the female form, but I think that Dalí also paints a lot of it because he's trying to parse how he himself felt. And there's a lot of paintings where figures are both man and woman, or both woman and man, which seems to be, again, him attempting to work out, how do I feel about having a body? Am I a man? Am I a woman trapped in a man's body? Do I like the body I've been given? I'm scared of other people's bodies, but yet I'm really attracted to them and I love watching them and observing them and painting them, which all kind of is very interlaced in a very strange way. And for the entire time that I was, you know, traveling around doing all this Dalí stuff, part of me was like, okay, is this story that I'm being told that Salvador Dalí had a relationship with his wife where they didn't engage in penetrative sex, but they had a very vibrant sex life where his wife would be with other men and he would watch. That was the dynamic of the myth of their relationship, right?
Wait a minute. Dolly was a cook?
Well, this is something that's really interesting, right? Is like he didn't want to have sex with people, but he was very interested and fascinated and aroused by sex. Like initially I was like, oh, this guy is just asexual, but there just wasn't a term for it at the time. And then I was like, oh no, because he is really interested and derives sexual pleasure from, you know, being a voyeur and voyeurism. So maybe I'm trying to bring like too much of a contemporary mindset to this and put him in more of a box than he actually was. Then there's certain periods where he's so intensely focused on the male form that I was like, oh, maybe he's gay. And that's what it is that he found somebody who fulfilled all of the logistical requirements of life in Gala. And they had an agreement that's like, you can go, you know, do whatever you want to do with these, you know, men. And as long as I'm included in the understanding of what's happening, whether that be literally an observation or just like, I know that stuff is going on, then that's fine. And then I was like, I don't know. The whole time I was literally in his bedroom. Like I was in his goddamn bedroom, which I don't want to talk about yet. I'll get to when we are there in the story because it is trippy.
I was sitting there jerking off in his chair and I was like, what is this guy's deal?
Yeah, dude. I was in his studio just like rubbing my nuts on his shit. And I was like, what is this guy's fucking deal, dude?
Let me get in your head.
Yeah. But it's interesting that the ideas of both being in a relationship and not being in a relationship with someone, or not being in a relationship in a way that we typically think about, that is very interesting to me. You know, finding someone in 1930 who was excited about and understood implicitly some version of an open marriage, whatever their version actually was versus what is being told to us now, 100 years later, is really interesting. I feel like people try these open relationship things now constantly and are like, it works. It's really healthy. It's really healthy. Oh, God. You know what I mean? Like, I know a few friends who've done things and let it. That's not true. Some people I do know that it has worked very well for them, and that's great. More power to them. And then a few people I know, things have ended very, very, very poorly.
It's interesting how you can, the life of this artist, you know, almost is up for interpretation, similar to his art. Because I find it interesting the way that people populate the sometimes ambiguous actions of people who, unlike today, wasn't always forthcoming about their intentions or the reasons why they did things or details about their personal lives. Because, you know, from everything you're describing, like, I agree with what you're saying and see how it's all valid. But also, from my perspective, I'm also hearing these details and just being like, oh, he was autistic. It's like the duality of wanting and desiring human warmth and companionship and affection, but also simultaneously not feeling comfortable with it, wanting to be left alone, not liking to be touched, feeling the attraction of human sexuality, but also being scared of it and not wanting to be too close and intimate with it. I see this all and I'm just like, oh yeah, the dude was fucking autistic. It was probably some combination of all of these things. It's not one or the other, especially considering the overlap with like queerness and neurodivergence. But I find it interesting that we're sort of like looking at this and imbuing it and populating it with our own interpretations of what the intentions behind things and why things were a certain way. It's almost like that was his point.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think some artists do live expressly with a point where the way they conduct their personal life and the way they project or create an image out of their personal life is part of the art. And then some people that is who they actually are, and they figure out a way to incorporate that into the kayfabe of their art. And then some people, it just is who they fucking are, and there's nothing they can do about it, and it runs directly in juxtaposition to the things they make, right? And I think those are the ones that are the most difficult to parse, where there are people who play that they're a good person, or they create work that is, you know, maybe a little more chaste, or that is more centered on things that don't have to do with something involving their personal life, and then their personal life is in direct contradiction to that, and the public is like, what the fuck is this? This isn't the bill of goods you've sold us. Like, what is this? The specifics of their relationship too are so interesting in that, like, you know, she's the one who set the prices for their paintings. She's the one who like booked all these shows for him. And when they get to New York, she's the one that really ingratiates them into the New York art scene and really is like, dude, Dali, he's like fucking famous. You should fucking look at this guy. He's Dali.
She was this Flavor Flav. She was just this hype person.
Yeah, or she was the Harvey Weinstein of him, you know, which is actually not that far off in terms of some of the stuff she does later. Like, she was an interesting person. Very interesting person. So this show that these two paintings are in includes 19 different paintings. 3 months after Dali declares that surrealism is over, he hosts an event called A Surrealistic Night in an Enchanted Forest in Monterey. So, you know, when there's money to be made, maybe surrealism isn't totally dead. This whole time period, you know, basically the late 30s to the mid 40s, Dali becomes one of the most famous artists in the world. The surrealism thing catches the globe's imagination. Also, he has some beef with Picasso that manifests, that gets a lot of people talking. He paints a couple portraits of Picasso. He does a couple sketches of Picasso, and they're very demeaning and intended to be incendiary. The idea is that he thinks Picasso is like wasting his talent, and that, you know, Picasso is a womanizer, and that he spends all his energy doing that and not creating artwork, and he's depriving the world of his talent, and also he's not even that talented, and blah, blah, blah. And it's very interesting, like, angry younger brother energy, where like Picasso is the biggest artist in the world, but Dali is like bucking against that, being like, God fucking damn it. But also, I owe this guy because he paid for my fucking boat ticket to the United States. Over the course of his life, Dali painted Picasso and drew Picasso like 12 or 15, 18 times, something like that. You know how many fucking times Picasso painted Dali? Zero.
It's kind of like how Kendrick just dropped that diss track where he came after Drake and J. Cole and was like, I'm the best rapper in the game, and just like fucking bodied both of them. But Drake's just like, I'm fucking rich and I don't care about being the best rapper.
Yeah.
He's just at Toronto Raptors games just hanging out.
It's also one of those things too of like, probably good he didn't respond to that. You know what I mean? Like, look how the one with him and what's his face went, where his son got outed.
No, 100%. Drake would have embarrassed himself.
Yeah. And he has responded to battle raps before though. Didn't he get in one with like Meek Mills?
Yeah, which, I mean, that was a little bit more of a level playing field. But Drake, he doesn't have the chops to drop like diss tracks. He just doesn't. You've read it before, but I wrote a sketch about Drake writing his response to Meek Mill's diss track, and he gets Ghostwriter from that 90s PBS show Ghostwriter to help him write the track.
Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't have the chops for it.
But also, who gives a shit? The guy's got literally hundreds of millions of dollars. Like, what does he care?
Yeah. Oh, just how I would feel. Like, I feel like even with like some of the ego I can have, I probably just don't have the constitution to be a rapper, because I'm just like, I don't care if you think you're better than me. Like, I don't give a shit. I'm just over here doing my thing. Yeah. I don't feel the need to like respond to you and like defend my position as greatest rapper.
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing that Dali did repeatedly, is at various points, whatever kind of period Picasso was in, that's what Dali would talk about. He was so tired of seeing. Like, there's a really funny interview with him where he talks about like, I'm so tired of seeing African art. African art is so over. We don't need it anymore. Which is him just like shitting on cubism. You know what I mean? Like, he's just like, I'm done.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with actually with African art or cubism. He just doesn't like Picasso because he's threatened by him because he was mean to him when he was 16 or whatever, and was like, you're never going to be a genius like me. You know, you're good, but you're 16. You're never going to be a genius. And since then, Dali dedicated his whole life to basically just like proving that he was a genius, which is really funny.
Yeah.
Act 3. Back when I was rapping for the hell of it, nowadays we rapping to stay relevant.
Salvador Dali is a self-confessed genius with an ingenious flair for publicity. An internationally renowned modern artist, he's also designed fur-lined bathtubs, he's lectured with his head enclosed in a diving helmet, and he claims that at the basis of his ideas are, as he puts it, cauliflowers and rhinoceros horns. He paints like this. Here you see perhaps his most famous work. It's called Persistence of Memory. In contrast to this dreamlike picture, here is Dali's surrealistic commentary on the horrors of war. It's called The Face of War. And now an example of Dali's latest phase, the crucifixion, showing his current preoccupation with religious subjects. Now let's try to find out some more about the enigma of Salvador Dali. Dali, first of all, let me ask you this. You're a remarkable painter, and you've dedicated your life to art. In view of this, why do you behave the way that you do? For instance, you have been known to drive in a car filled to the roof with cauliflowers. You lectured, as I mentioned, once with your head enclosed in a diving helmet, and you almost suffocated. You issue bizarre statements about your love for rhinoceros horns and so on. You're a dedicated artist. Why do you, or why must you, do these things?
Because this kind of eccentricities correspond to the more important and the more tragical part of my life.
The more important and the more tragical part. I don't understand.
The more philosophical.
What is philosophical about driving in a car full of cauliflowers or lecturing inside
because
a driving
discovered, car? Because make one tremendous speech, almost pseudo-scientific, in the Sorbonne in Paris, about my discovering of the logarithmic curve of cauliflowers.
The what?
Logarithmic aspiral.
Oh, yes. The logarithmic curve, yes.
And in the same time, the logarithmic aspiral in the horn of rhinoceros. In this time, discover this is the symbol of chastity, one of the most powerful symbols of modern times.
Chastity is one of the most powerful symbols of modern times?
In my opinion, it's the more urgent and the more dramatic. Because the chastity represents the force of spirit.
And lecturing...
This is the reason the priest is chaste in any religion, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because of the promiscuity, the people make love, is no more spiritual strength, no more spiritual force.
Yes. Well, we will get to your spirituality, your increasing spirituality over the years in just a moment. About lecturing with your head enclosed in a diving helmet. Why? Why?
Because in this moment, like, the audience understand...
Okay, so let's stop it right here. So I have a lot of thoughts about what he's saying.
Dude loves him some metaphorical dicks going into things.
Yep, yeah. So a couple things there. One, Dali is very aware of branding and being perceived as someone filled with eccentricities because it inherently imbues his surrealistic artwork as having more possible meanings in various metaphorical ways. The funny thing to me, though, is that his version of, like, it's a metaphor is like, I want to dive deep into the human subconscious. How do I do this? I wear a diving suit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the things that he was describing him doing, the like eccentricities that he was describing, it reminded me of that episode of Community whenever they have a teacher who's like, he's like a Robin Williams style, like eccentric guy, and he keeps failing Jeff Winger because he's not being spontaneous enough. And then Jeff Winger thinks it's like an easy A class and he gets an F. And then he's like, he's trying to be spontaneous and eccentric in order to get an A, but the guy is like, you're faking it. You're not being really spontaneous. And he keeps failing him. And the teacher guy, who's that guy who's in a lot of Christopher Guest movies, I forget what his name is. He's like in the cafeteria and he's talking to Jeff Winger and being like, you're not being spontaneous enough. You're faking it or whatever. And then he's like, you don't understand what it really means to be spontaneous. And then he goes up to the lunch counter and he's going to order and he looks at the menu and he's like, I'll have... And then he rips the menu in half and goes, a birthday cake. And then everybody like applauds him. That's what all those things reminded me of. This really grandiose show of eccentricity that's like totally contrived in a really funny way.
Yeah, but like in, you know, 1958, like, wow, it's a metaphor. Like one of the other things that Dali was really big on is that like he believed that people used all of their trauma as a crutch to get them through daily life. And so in his museum, there are literally crutches and literally drawers because he had this idea that people keep their trauma in mental drawers in their brain, like put into the walls of the museum. And you're like, dude, come on. Like, I see what you're doing, but like, this is the most basic bitch version of this metaphor. you know?
It's like the direct opposite of David Lynch's, like, imagery, where he has this, like, very overtly, intentionally obtuse visual symbolism in his movies that he refuses to explain, where it's just like, you know, I had this dead cat and I let it soak in this tar and it became impregnated by the tar. And then I put it into this glass jar and it was like a cat in a glass jar. And the interviewer is like, what does that mean? And he's like, fuck you.
Eraserhead is my most spiritual film. Oh, explain that. No.
Yeah, just like intentionally obtuse and refusing to like make any kind of connection between his visual symbolism and like what he means. Yeah. Salvador Dali is like, yes, it's like impregnating the ocean with my ideas. So I put a diving helmet on so that I can stick my head into the ocean of ideas. Do you see? Do you understand?
Yeah, but it's interesting to see that the nascent version of like building a persona, building the art world, quote unquote, the great artist archetype, and then sending it out into the real world, and then having straight world media be like, you're an artist. What does it mean when you drove a car filled with cauliflower? What it means is I want to be perceived as strange and artistic so that idiots like you will ask me what it means.
But instead I'll say, yes, it's the logarithmic patterns of the cauliflower.
So in 1948, Gala and Salvador Dali move back to Spain, to Port Lligat specifically. They bought 5 fishermen houses there, small kind of like village cottages, and they turned them into one massive estate, or massive estate for you know, Port Lligat, Spain, I suppose. The interesting thing about it is you can't go there. It's very regulated when you go to his house. So as I said earlier in the episode, I went there and it was fascinating because it's these 4 or 5 homes that are connected by hallways that he's built. And it took them like 15 or 20 years to finish renovating all of the houses and turning it into what it is. And there's all these eccentric things that are still kept in the house to this day. The house is basically untouched from when he died in like the late 70s, early 80s. And one, everything is very timed specifically. Like, it's not like a museum where you just like go check out his house. It's like you show up at 10:45. If you're not there at 10:45, you're not fucking seeing the house. Goodbye. So you go in there, and the first room you go into is this little kind of like foyer room where there's a fucking polar bear. There's just a giant stuffed polar bear that confronts you when you walk in. The room is probably about, I don't know, maybe a 10 by 10 room, 10 by 7 room. And then to your left is a hallway. You go up that hallway and there's kind of like a sitting room where there's a couch on the left that's yellow and then some shelving units on the right. You go through that room and there's his library where there's 2 reading chairs, shelves that have a bunch of books on them, and a big bay window. You go through a hallway after that and you enter basically his bedroom. It's like a 2-tiered room where there's like a tier here that is like couches and like a sitting area with a door on the right side that leads to the kitchen and a couple bathrooms. And then an open aired stairway that leads to his and Gala's bedroom, which was a large, almost kind of like an amphitheater feeling room that has 2 beds. Each bed has a giant like cape thing draped from the ceiling. I don't even know how to describe it. It's like one of those like Victorian bedpost mosquito net things.
Oh, like a canopy?
Yeah, like a canopy, but it's only the front of the canopy draped on the walls. So their beds look like thrones almost. And A, it was very interesting to me that they slept in 2 beds. Because I guess there were, you know, people from the generation where you just slept in 2 beds, not shared a bed with somebody. But also the fact that the room was so bright, like it had like 4 windows. And so the second that sun comes up, those motherfuckers were awake, dude. Like they were awake, which was very like, oh man, you guys don't sleep in. There's no curtains in this room. The interesting thing about his house specifically, though, You know, as we've discussed, over their marriage, Gala had many romantic partners, and Salvador Dali, according to, you know, the entrenched dogma about him, never did. But he would always watch and was kind of obsessed with being a voyeur while she had sexual encounters. And this is the tip of the spear, no pun intended. This is the best version of this.
Yes, it's the logarithmic pattern of that guy's ass just jackhammering my wife.
So we're in the bedroom, and the tour guide for the Dali house goes, okay, now we're going to go see Dali's listening room. And we were like, oh, a listening room? What does that mean? It's like, oh, Dali had a listening room. We're going to go experience the listening room. Let's go. So we leave the bedroom, go through a bathroom, through the kitchen, and then we turn left, we go outside, and there's a building that's kind of shaped like a gourd. You know, like a... That's a gourd, right?
Yes, that is a gourd. That thing you're doing is a gourd. Also, more classically, maybe the shape of the classical hourglass body shape of a woman that was very popular in the 1940s and 50s. Maybe that's what it was inspired by.
Possibly. I don't know. But it's pink. So we walk inside it, and it is a room that has been constructed to reverberate sound in a very specific way. The tour guide goes, yeah, Dali loved to listen to people talk and whisper. So if you whisper on one side of the room, you can hear it on the other. It kind of sounded like standing in a pool that had no water in it.
There's a lot of rooms that are designed that way, listening rooms, where you can stand on one side and then like hear people just like talking at a normal volume or whisper, like on the other side of the building because of the way that it's constructed.
This room was an orgy room. Like 100% it was an orgy room. It had like very low seating. It was constructed so that he could probably sit either outside or on the periphery of the circumference of the room and watch people do things. And yeah, it was funny. We were all standing in that room and I turned to my sister and I was like, this is an orgy room. And she was like, what? They said it was a listening room. And I'm like, say something again. And she was like, what are you talking? Oh, this is an orgy room.
And then you said, if you were only my cousin.
Yeah, if you were only my fucking cousin. So I think that's also a very fascinating permutation of this, that like not only was he very invested in the cycle of kind of like fulfilling Gala's desires, but also that her desires became his desires and that he built this room to facilitate that. I think that's a fascinating kind of snake eating its own tail of sexual desire and interpersonal dynamics. The other thing that was really interesting about his house is he has a giant pool area in the back. You want to guess what shape the pool was?
Just a big old dick.
A penis.
Yeah.
Just a giant penis-shaped pool. That's hell about the yeah. time where I was like, was this guy gay? Like, is this whole voyeur thing just him not wanting to leave the safety of his relationship with Gala?
No. You see, the penis is the ideal shape for a swimming pool because you can maximize the length of it for doing laps, but then the narrow space of the shaft is a great place to, you know, socialize, get together in groups. So it's like the best of both worlds of a more kind of casual social pool experience and also a more athletic lap-based swimming experience. That's why it's shaped like that.
So one of the other things that I wanted to bring up about Dali, which is really interesting, is this kind of willingness to do whatever it takes, right? And it's interesting to kind of try and parse how much of that motivation is from Gala and how much of that is actually organically from Dali, because, you know, they move across the world partly to escape, you know, war-torn Spain and France, and also partly to, you know, launch this career in the New York art world. And he wouldn't be who he was globally if he had not done that. Also, you know, you have the concessions or interpersonal arrangements that they have with one another, which also obviously facilitated his success. That reaches a head when they come back to Spain after World War II, you know, in about 48, 49, they come back.
Before we go on that, what you just said, and all, what we were talking about before, it's also just really interesting to look back on these sort of like iconoclastic figures that feel, you know, very 20,000 feet tall in our minds because they've sort of always existed to us and they've always been very iconic, and to sort of like reassess them with logic or newly found information to them. And I'm not even saying this is a bad thing, but it's really interesting to think about a figure like Salvador Dali and think of him as like, oh, he was this really eccentric, surrealist artist who just had this sort of like eccentric, artistic deepness to him that made him just like a little bit more special than your average person. And he was this genius, and that's why he did the things that he did, and that's why he was as great as he was, and why he's as iconic as he is. And to think back on it and apply these new filters and be like, oh no, not that he wasn't necessarily a genius or that his work is not necessarily good, but all of this stuff we're talking about, all of this like X factor genius eccentricity, it was all just like marketing. It was two people just like marketing him. It's really interesting to look back on it. And a lot of figures are like that. You know, you look back on people like Jim Morrison, who was thought of as this like, you know, really special figure, this revolutionary, this person who was like a really deep thinker and a poet. And it's like, no, basically they were a boy band and he was just marketing himself as this like bad boy revolutionary. He didn't do anything revolutionary. He just was in a band. It's really interesting to look back on these people and reassess them and be like, oh, it's all just fucking marketing.
And also, Frank, fascinating how that marketing gets absorbed into the culture in various ways. You know what I mean? Like, because somebody like Morrison is in a performance-based medium, it's easier to disseminate the idea that he is exemplary or charismatic or interesting because you see him doing a thing. Salvador Dali is a guy who put some paint on some canvas. Granted, there's an infrastructure around it because the fine art world craves that type of commoditization, but it doesn't have the same level of immediacy to it that the, you know, film or music or other performance-based art forms do.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The fact that the primary medium that you work through is comics, people don't see your face. If people just were able to see the angle of that hair, the shape of it, how high it is, you would be way more famous.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key point for Mary Tyler Moore Hawk. I put three Dave Bakers in the book, but I really should have put three Dave Bakers with really good hairdos in the book. I should have really been explicit about the hair.
You fucked up.
So going back to what I was saying in terms of like, you know, he seems like somebody who's willing to do whatever it takes. When he comes back to Spain, Franco is still in power. If people don't know, Franco's the Spanish dictator that controlled Spain during the Second World War and did a lot of really not good things. He was a fascist. And a lot of people were really pissed off at Franco. And at the end of the war, when Dali returned, a lot of people were curious what he was going to do. Like when he got off the plane and landed back in Spain, was he going to say like, Franco sucks, we need to get him the fuck out of here? Or was he, what was he going to do? So he gets off the plane and he says like, I love Franco. Franco's great. He gets called to Franco's fucking mansion or whatever. And he's like, hey, what's going on, man? You like me? And he's like, yeah. I love you. I love you. I love you. I love fascism. Love fascism. Can I have a museum? He's like, well, yeah, sure. What kind of museum? You want a museum? Well, I guess, yeah, sure. I'll give you a museum because you love me and you love fascism. Love it.
I'm loving everything you do. All that stuff you do, all the little things that you're doing. It's my favorite. Can I have a museum?
Sure. Where do you want it? I want it to be in Figueres, where I was born. Which building? I want it to be in the old theater. Well, I don't know if we can do that. I'm Dali, and I love fascism, and I love you, Franco, the massive fascism guy. Can I please have a museum? All right, you can have a museum.
I don't know if we can do that. I don't know. Maybe fascism isn't so good. It's kind of I'm starting to go at a crossroads. Maybe I'm a little woker than I thought I was. Okay, fine. You can have the museum at the theater. Oh, yes, fascism.
The other thing, too, that he does a little bit around this time, it's a little later, honestly, it's like late 50s, early 60s, this is how fucking famous Salvador Dali was. He goes, I want a meeting with the Pope. The Catholic Church is like, I don't know. And he's like, no. I want a meeting with the Pope. I'm Salvador Dali. And they're like, all right, fine, come on in. He shows up and he's like, Mr. the Pope, I want to make the greatest religious artwork that's ever been made. And I want you, the papacy, to back it. I want you to say, this shit is great. The Pope is like, I don't know, man. We got a lot of motherfuckers painting stuff. I don't know. He goes, no. I'm Salvador Dali. I'm the greatest painter alive. And the Pope is like, well, isn't that Picasso? And he's like, no, it's me. I'm the greatest painter alive. So I want you to back my paintings. I want you to pay me a shitload of money. And I want you to point to them as the greatest religious paintings of all time. And the Pope was like, bro, aren't you like unmarried and like have weird voyeuristic orgies and shit? And Dali's like, yeah. But you know, I've been with my wife for like fucking 30 years now, 40 years. Like, I'm monogamous, sort of.
When you really think about it, isn't it the most Christian thing to just never have sex ever?
Yeah.
Aren't I like the most Christian ever? Aren't I just like the best guy? I think I'm the best guy. And even further, to sit and watch people having a mass orgy. That's the temptation. And to resist the temptation, to be confronted with it and resist it, I think I'm the best guy.
And the Pope is like, all right, I'll make you a deal. You got married in a civil service because you can't get married because you and Gala are both Catholic and Catholics can't get married a second time. But I can't have you making all these paintings of Jesus and backed by us if you're not married. And he's like, okay, you're the fucking Pope. You're going to help us out? And the Pope was like, yeah. All right, we'll get you guys real married. We'll get you real, real married.
I got a guy.
Yeah, I got a guy.
I got a marriage guy.
Yeah. And then you'll do these paintings, but I need to see the layouts of the paintings and approve them before you finish them so that you don't embarrass the church. Because if we're going to like back these and say that they're like official works that the Vatican has sponsored, and then you do something really heretical or sacrilegious, like that's going to make us look bad. And he's like, okay. So they got married. He got a fuckload of money from the church. And he made these paintings that we're going to talk about briefly. What do you think about these two paintings of Jesus and the crucifixion?
The gayest things I've ever seen.
Also weirdly scary. Like really scary.
Yeah, very, very homoerotic and also apocalyptic and terrifying.
So the first one is you're like above Jesus being crucified. The perspective is that the cross's main terminus is like going out of a gigantic void of blackness into an idyllic scene of a boat on a lakefront. And I've been here. I've literally stood right in front of where that boat is, because that is the view from the front of Salvador Dali's house in Port, whatever the fuck it is called, Port Legat, which is really strange because I've seen this painting, you know, tons and tons of times. And then standing right there being like, oh my God, this is the bottom of that painting? Was super fucking weird for me. Then the other one is also a crucifixion piece, but it is four like intersecting box geometric shapes that are making a cross with Jesus suspended, hovering in midair in front of the cross and Mary looking up and kind of mourning him. And Mary, if you'll pay attention, Mr. Spandrew Spice, does that face look familiar?
Yeah, I believe it is. I believe that is, we got ourselves a cuck Jesus here.
Yep, that Virgin Mary is Gala. But this is the reason why I'm bringing these up is, one, because they're really fucking cool paintings. Two, because they're so scary. And three, because they, along with the, I just totally love fascism now, of Dali, is very interesting to me in terms of he's a guy who's willing to do anything to get to the next level and succeed.
This is the equivalent of Greta Gerwig being like, yes, I will make a Barbie movie.
Yeah.
To shape my career and move from making like mid-budget indie dramas to getting to direct like a Marvel film.
Yeah, totally. You know, I've said it before on the show, every true artist's medium is compromise. And it really doesn't feel like Salvador Dali had any problems with compromise. He was just like, I don't give a fuck. Let's do it. You want to fuck my wife? Great. I love it. This is like my whole thing. You want to fucking give me money to paint Jesus? I don't give a shit about any of the bad things that the Catholic Church has done. So now we kind of enter the last act of the story, which, as you might anticipate, gets a little sad, because the last act of most people's lives gets a little sad. In the 60s, after they've moved back to Spain, Dalí spends an extended period of time building a castle for Gala. He designs it. He makes all these paintings of it, all these paintings on the interior of it, and he gifts it to her. And she says, I will accept this on one condition. If I accept this gift of this castle that you made me, you will never come here unless you have a written invitation from me. And he agrees to it. And they are planning to be buried in this castle. There's tombs in the bottom of the castle, and there's a passageway that connects them so they can hold hands together in the afterlife. And she holds weekly orgies there that he's not invited to. And this is the kind of beginning of the erosion of their relationship.
This whole relationship is just that one meme of like the rage face guy who's like all like looking like this. And it's like, yes, dear, this is just that meme.
I mean, at this point, like, they've been together for 40-something years. They're in their 60s, early 70s at this point, and she's just, like, running through it, man. She's excited about life, and he's over here, not in the castle. He doesn't live in the castle. She lives in the castle. He lives at the house that I visited in Port Lligat, and then she comes and stays there sometimes, but it's mostly him, is my understanding. And so, you know, they have this arrangement for a little while, and then around the time that she's around 80 years old, things take a turn. She falls in love with 22-year-old actor Jeff Fenholt, who was the lead in Jesus Christ Superstar. 22, she's like in her 80s. That's a pretty significant gap. But also, this isn't we're just developing a physical relationship. She decides to leave Dalí for Jeff Fenholt. And she says, I'm going to do with Fenholt what I did with Salvador Dali. I'm going to make Jeff Fenholt the world's greatest singer, actor ever. This just destroys Salvador Dali, who, you know, is in his late 70s at this point, I think. And he's like, you're fucking kidding me, right? Like this is what's going to tear us apart? This, after everything we've been through? So they separate, and he's just completely demolished as a human being. He doesn't even know if he wants to live anymore.
The logarithmic patterns of my fetal position body crying on the bathroom floor.
Exactly, exactly. So he kind of doesn't know what to do with himself, and not that long after, I think 3 years after they separate, she dies. She dies of, like, tuberculosis or something? I don't remember what, but some like flu-related thing.
She died of being just a big old bitch. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. I'm going through some stuff right now. I sound more Italian than Spanish.
It really does, more Italian, yeah. He buries her at the castle, right? You know, after everything she does, he buries her in the castle.
You don't get two Dalís, because anybody ever heard of Jeff Fenholt?
No, but to me, that kind of makes sense to me of like, I mean, I'm not condoning this. I think Gala was something of a monster, which we'll get into in a minute. But if you can see your time on the earth coming to an end, it makes sense to be like, I have enough time. I can do it again. I did the impossible. I won the lottery. I can do it again. I can take somebody and make them a massive star again.
Yeah, if your skill set or the thing that you strive to be in your life and the thing that you have hung your entire self-worth and identity on is like taking people and transforming them into successes that are removed from your own personal, you know, ownership of those successes to a certain degree for a long time, that person is a work in progress. Like, there's always more power. There's always more fame. There's always more that you can accomplish. Even when you're very famous and very powerful and very rich, there's always more, or at least that's what it feels like. That's the spirit of a sort of like capitalistic fame obsessed society is like, you can always have more. But then when you're 80, it's like, I think maybe this is kind of the end. Like, I don't know if Salvador Dali has much more to go. Like, I think maybe he's reached his peak and it's all downhill from here. I don't think there's no more battles for Alexander to fight. So then, yeah, to your point, it's like, oh, well, maybe I can slip in another quick little rise to power before I go. Slip in a little quick one.
Yeah, just a little quickie, right? Just a little quickie making a global superstar, you know?
Yeah.
So Dali, I think they met before she passed, but they got a lot closer after they passed. Dali met this woman named Amanda Lear, who was a cabaret singer and has some interesting gender identity things surrounding her as well, which are fascinating. And they become lovers towards the end of his life. They spend a lot of time together. And the urban legend, who knows if this is true, is that, you know, when he was at his darkest place debating not living anymore, you know, he was like, I don't know how to live without Gala. And she said to him, imagine living a life trapped in the wrong body. You know, I'm trapped in the body of a man and I want to be a woman, or I am a woman. And that is a very difficult thing to navigate. And so Dali, according to urban legend, paid for her to have her gender reassignment surgery. And they spent the last X number of years of his life together, which is also fascinating because it's yet another example of Dali being surrounded by people of alternative gender identities or alternative sexual orientations, and the duality and conflicting interpersonal struggles that those people were going through is something that he obviously was also dealing with and working through himself in various ways, which I think is fascinating considering the time that he was alive. I mean, obviously trans people have been around forever, right? But usually people that rise through the cultural ranks lose sensitivity to that. They lose a sense of empathy when money and fame show up, you know? Like Johnny Rotten is out here fucking being pro-Trump and shit. And it's fascinating to me that Salvador Dali had all of those concerns, interests, proclivities, you know, however that manifested for him. For me, it's still not really clear, because a lot of this is like, we're talking about the version of events that he and or the people in his orbit have disseminated, which, as we've talked about, he's a really good marketer. He's a really good controller of the narrative, or Gallo is a really good controller of the narrative. And therefore, it kind of always feels like there's a piece of the information that's maybe not fully in the discussion. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's also interesting because under the reading that, you know, that Salvador Dali might have had some kind of gender identity struggles going on internally that obviously he really never like fully externalized in a very public way. Under the possibility of that, there's also like this element of like living vicariously through somebody else. This idea of paying for the gender reassignment surgery of somebody and saying like, you're young. You know, we live in a slightly more progressive time. I'm 80 years old, like, and this isn't actually even true because you can come to grips and acknowledge your own gender identity whenever you want. But in his mind, like, I'm 80, like, I can't do this anymore. I never was able to, like, confront this or be open about it or be honest about it. But you're young. You can do this. I will pay to gift you this thing. To live vicariously through that act and be like, this is like what I could have done, but I never had the courage or I never felt comfortable doing it or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's right on par with, you know, him being a voyeur. That makes total sense. And I hadn't even really thought of that in this context. I hadn't just interpreted it as like, I am struggling with this as well in some form. And I want to help alleviate that for you in a way that I might not be able to for myself, because I'm not necessarily sure what it is for me. But it totally makes sense of what you're saying of like, maybe that literally was the voyeurism. Let's read these two little wiki articles about Amanda Lear, just to give the listener a little bit more context about their relationship and when they met and how often they knew each other and stuff.
Now, really quick, before we say that, so Amanda Lear was a trans go-go dancer. The name Amanda Lear is like supposed to be like a pun, right?
Yeah, her actual name, I think, was something Tap. I can't think of her first name now. But here's the thing is, she also maybe wasn't trans. This is a thing that there's been debate about, where she has said she's not trans and she has said she was trans at various points in time for different reasons. And that's very interesting. And there's no, there's the rumor is that Dali paid for her transition after that conversation, but neither of them ever confirmed it, to my understanding. But she has a pseudonym, which is Amanda Lear.
Amanda Lear was introduced to the eccentric Spanish surrealist painter Salvador Dali in Paris. The self-proclaimed enfant terrible in the world of art, 35 years her senior, was struck by her looks and found a soulmate in her. She has since described their close and unconventional relationship as a spiritual marriage and remained Dali's confidant, protege, and closest friend through the next 16 years. She spent every summer with Dali at his home at Port Lligat in Catalonia, Spain, and accompanied him and his wife on trips to Barcelona, Madrid, Paris, and New York. She also took part in his art projects, posing for a number of Dali's drawings and paintings, including The Dream of Hypnos in 1965, Venus in Furs, 1968, Angelus de Millet, Amanda, Angelique Rescued from the Dragon, from 1970, Bateau Anthropique, from 1971, and Exploding Head in 1982. Dali and Lear would later collaborate on a giant 7-foot-wide by 4-foot-high collage fan. Lear can be found as Temperance in Salvador Dali's Tarot, in which she claimed to have assisted Dali in the completion of the collages. Despite Lear contradicting transgender allegations on numerous occasions and explaining they were part of a strategy to draw public attention, the allegations continued to persist. In 1976, Lear stated that it was, quote, a crazy idea from some journalist, and later claimed that the rumor had been started by Dali or even herself.
Which is fascinating. I think any way you position it, it's interesting. It's interesting if she's a trans artist who bonded with Dali because of that identity and that he helped facilitate it. It's fascinating if she's a, well, it's a little less fascinating this way. It's a little bit more appropriative and maybe not so great if she's a cis woman who was pretending to be trans in order to stoke public ire. But I guess if you look at it in the best case scenario, she's somebody trying to spread awareness about trans rights, and still feels a little weird to me.
There's definitely shades of gray. It reminds me of something which we'll do an episode on someday about a woman in the 1970s who basically would sort of, quote, cosplay as disabled people by like strapping certain things to her body in order to like impede her ability to walk. And she would go around in wheelchairs. And it was essentially a way for her to like test out the accessibility buildings and landscapes in cities. And she collected, she did this for a couple of years, going around the entire country of, in the United States, and like basically dressing up as disabled people to test out the accessibility options. And then she took all these notes that she compiled into a book that eventually had a lot of influence on the way that we approach accessibility here in the United States. And once again, there's this gray area of like, I feel like it's pretty objectively good what she did, but also she was sort of appropriating being a disabled person to do basically a performance art experiment that had some positive benefits to it. But similar to this, is there's a gray area where it's like, you know, to a certain degree, this is like just interesting and just a very peculiar way of approaching presenting yourself publicly. And then there's an element of it of a like, oh yeah, but that's also kind of weird that you did that.
But I mean, overall, I think the discussion is kind of what we've been hitting on of, you know, this discussion around Salvador Dali's mercurial, slightly unreliable narrator sex life, how that impacted his artwork, how that kind of gets context laundered when the work is looked at in a void of that interpersonal knowledge, and how much more interesting the work is when you know that this is the narrative of what the work is a result of, whether that narrative is a little falsified or accurate. Either way, I think is interesting to me. Do you have any final thoughts, Mr. Spandrew Spice?
Yeah, I just find that intersection in a world where people are driven to artistic expression to varying degrees, and for better or worse, probably mostly for worse in most situations, in most contexts, that artistic expression has been inexorably interlinked with capitalism, profit-seeking, and this fetishism with fame and celebrity that we have mostly in Western culture, but I think to varying degrees in many countries across the world. And the way that one influences the other in very interesting and very strange and often very problematic ways. And I find it incredibly fascinating. We talked about that guy on TikTok who does the like self-made is a myth and how kind of irksome I find that. And it's like he's not technically wrong, but it just feels like you're putting a lot of energy into something that is maybe better spent elsewhere. I just find it more interesting the way that people play with personas. They play with marketing concepts in order to present themselves publicly in a certain way in order to control a narrative around themselves and manipulate people into thinking of them in a certain way for the sole express intent of furthering their ability to distribute their artwork to a larger group of people. You know, I think ultimately at the end of the day, somebody like Salvador Dali, he just wants to make paintings, and maybe it's for the love of the craft, or maybe it's because he just wanted to make some money from his paintings. I don't know specifically which one it is, but it's interesting that along with that comes this package of like, in order to do that at a certain scale and very successfully, I have to do all this weird bullshit and like pretend like I'm this crazy eccentric guy. And you see that a lot with a lot of different things. It's not just eccentricity, but it's also like shock. I find it fascinating that these artists come along periodically that intentionally do these shocking publicity stunts to offend a lot of people so that they're talked about, so that they become more famous. And it's this weird cycle where this happens over and over again. And we talked about this on the Britney Spears episode, or rather you and Andrew talked about this on the Britney Spears episode, this idea of like some old video interview I saw where Gene Simmons from Kiss went on to this British talk show. And back in the day, before they like unmasked themselves, Kiss used to be like fully kayfabe. Like they would pretend like they were real, like a real demon and a real guy from space and a real cat monster. And they would go on to interviews and they would like, and Gene Simmons would like say crazy satanic shit or whatever. But it was all just a performance art stunt to make themselves more famous. And they're capitalizing on the fact that people are going to clutch their pearls about them saying this like weird satanic shit. And that'll get them talked about in news, which will expose them to a bunch of teenagers who will be interested in them and listen to their music. And it's all this marketing strategy that's churned over and over again. And people do it and it continues to happen. Sam Smith performed on the Grammys a couple of years ago and they were like wearing like a fucking cartoon devil from the 1940s costume. And there was like a bunch of like demon people on the stage and it caused a bunch of like religious and conservative people to be like, Satan has infiltrated the music industry. And it's like, no, they're just trying to get, they're trying to offend you so that you'll talk about them so that they'll become more famous. It's like, it's a very well-worn strategy and it's crazy that you still fall for it after all these years. And I find that very fascinating. I find the intermingling between artistic expression and the need to market yourself and how they influence each other in very powerful ways. Because like we've talked about throughout this entire episode, all this stuff was just like Salvador Dali and mostly Gala like marketing him as a personality to make him more famous. But it informs his artwork because you can't help but associate the way that he presented himself with his artwork and allow it to inform the meaning of his paintings. So you look at his paintings and your knowledge of him informs how you interpret the meaning of the paintings. And that's extremely fascinating.
On that note, I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Spandrew Spice.
This has been Deep Cuts. If you'd like to find me on the internet, you can do so at heydavebaker.com. Please go buy my book, Mary Tyler Moorhawk. Spandrew, where can people find you on the internet?
If you want to pay your respects to the dear beloved Papa Pricey, you can get his book, Deadbolt AI Private Eye, by going to dapricewrites.com, picking up Deadbolt AI Private Eye. It's a comic about a robotic detective in the future that solves crimes. You can follow us on social media by going to Facebook and searching Deep Cuts Podcast. You can join our Facebook group, the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group, where we talk about the show and make memes and have a cool little community there. You can also join our Discord server, bit.ly.com/deepcutsdiscord, where we talk about the show, make memes. And quite honestly, listeners have way more access to me than I feel like they even should, because, you know, I work, my job requires bursts of intense mental concentration, and then I end up blowing off steam by jumping into the Discord and just having conversations with listeners. I feel like not many podcasts give you this level of access to their hosts, so take advantage of it. You can follow us on Instagram at Deep Cuts Pod. You can follow us on TikTok at Mystery Treehouse. You can follow me on TikTok at Dead Boy Detective. Deep Cuts is a production by Boy Genius Media. If you'd like to find this show and others like it, please visit boygeniusmedia.com or deepcutspod.com.
If you want to join in on post-episode discussions, please join the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group. Finally, subscribe to our YouTube channel for additional video content.